and Chris, and this is my Writing Table podcast, where we talk to authors and other creatives about the writing world and what it takes to create the books that we love to read. Ready? Pull up a chair and let's begin. Katrina Kittle remembers thinking of herself as a writer way back in grade school, although she never thought about writing for publication, that is, until she graduated from college. Former classmates to this day tease her about the interminable stories she was always writing about horses or bands of stray animals. She inherited this love of books and storytelling from her dad, who encouraged her to read great books long before the same titles were required in school. Her dad still greets her at the door whenever she visits with, "Did you bring me any books?" Her curiosity, imagination, and passion for adventure come from her mom, who taught her always to look at the world with the discovering eyes of a child. Katrina has written several novels for adults, including The Blessings of the Animals, The Kindness of Strangers, Two Truths and a Lie, and Traveling Light. And she wrote Reasons to be Happy for young adults. Her characters are people we know, people we are, and people we've been. They find themselves in circumstances they'd never imagined they'd face, and we're compelled to follow them as they find their way home, heal what's broken, and discover strength they didn't know they had. Katrina's latest novel, Morning in This Broken World, was an Amazon First Reads pick for August. Welcome, Katrina.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
You have written several adult novels and one YA. Your latest, Morning in the Broken World, was chosen as an Amazon First Picks read for August. Congratulations, by the way.
That's huge. Thank you.
I'm sure they're all wonderful. What do you think Amazon saw to name it as a first pick?
Ooh, what a good question. Well, it is, I think, pretty timely, which may be one of the appeals. It's set during the pandemic, but it's not really a pandemic novel. COVID is the catalyst for these characters coming together, but it's not the focus of the whole story. So if you're like, oh God, I don't want to read about the pandemic, it's not really that book, but it starts in March of 2020 and it ends in June of 21. And I think it was kind of this time. It's about finding light in dark places. And I think that's another thing that probably appealed to them. But well, if only we knew what exactly it was, we could, you know, capture that and do it again, right?
I adore the cover. Depending on how you look at it, it could be confetti or it could be chaos. What do you see when you see the cover?
Yes. Oh my gosh. I loved the confetti and chaos. It is true. It could be a flower, which fits because Vivian has a garden.
I see that.
It could be the coronavirus. What you saw is confetti. There's a character, Ren, who makes collages, and it's a little bit like it brings to mind her collages. And it does, you know, it's got brokenness and all those torn little pieces mm-hmm. that come together to form something beautiful. So, hey, there's the theme.
A little bit like a Rorschach test.
What do you see when you look at this cover? But I just think it's so striking and beautiful. I was so thrilled with it.
Morning in This Broken World received rave reviews from authors like Jessica Strasser, whom we love, and Adriana Triani, who said, "Kittle has written a beautiful and emotional novel about the families we choose to create when we need them the most." So tell us about Morning in This Broken World.
We have four point of view characters, but we start with Vivian, who's a recent widow. She is wanting to bust out of her assisted living community because
as one does.
Right. It's going into lockdown and she cannot bear to be trapped in the apartment where her husband recently died. She doesn't actually need services. She was only there in support of him. And they still own their previous home, but she's gone back to that home a few times since he passed and it feels too haunted for her. She's a little scared of herself when she's there. And actually, this is not a spoiler because this is on page one. She's actually contemplating leaving this world to join Jack. But there's a knock on the door and it's her favorite nursing assistant, Luna, who helps take beautiful care of Vivian's husband. And through a series of events, Vivian learns that Luna is newly separated and about to be evicted. And Vivian, in this rush that may seem really rash, but this idea that they're going to be locked in, they can't go to dinner, they don't have social activities, she can't go anywhere. And if she does, she has to quarantine, you know, when she comes back, she's like, "You guys move in with me." Luna has two kids. Because of a series of events in Luna's life, she's kind of forced to do this, even though she doesn't want to accept the charity as she sees it. Luna has two kids, Ren, who's 11 years old. She has cerebral palsy, and 15-year-old Cooper, who's pretty angry, always in trouble, and really struggling to figure out who he's supposed to be in the world. So these four unlikely people come to Vivian's giant house that happens to be handicap accessible because of her previous mother-in-law. And it's kind of a perfect setting. And they decide they're going to ride out the pandemic together. And they become this bound family. All four of them were wearing like armor and were kind of guarded against the world way before the pandemic happened. And it's the coming together that allows them to kind of shed those previous shells and emerge as their more authentic selves, right? So they're all sort of changed from coming together.
Did you have to do any research on caregiving, the assisted living?
Yeah, well, that comes from personal experience with my parents.
I had a feeling.
My dad still lives in this retirement community. He's actually still in independent living. And he has some aides who come and help him in the morning and the evening. But for the most part, he can do what he needs to do himself. He moved there with my mother, who had dementia. And we lost her in January of 2020. So right before everybody was becoming aware of the pandemic. It sounds weird, but if you've had any experience with dementia or Alzheimer's, it was kind of a blessing that she passed before the lockdown, because I think the masks would have scared her and she wouldn't have understood why we weren't coming. You know, she was finally out of that confusion and at peace.
Yeah.
But I was just so acutely aware of my dad with that combination of the isolation and the grief. And that's a terrible combination because this facility took great care of everyone. But, you know, he had just moved from assisted living where he was there to be with my mom to an apartment in the same building that was independent. So he's got new neighbors, a new apartment, everything's different. He's newly alone. And suddenly he's kind of stuck by himself.
Yeah.
Fortunately, he reads. He's a voracious reader. He's why I'm a writer, to be honest. I talked to him every day because we weren't allowed to see him unless we went outside. We met outside a lot and it had to be really wretched weather for us not to go out. You know, I'd be like, are you bored? And he goes, no, I've got plenty of books. I'm just lonely. And it just broke my heart. And then we also had a really dear friend who had lost her husband to pancreatic cancer shortly before that new year. And so again, with those two, with my dad and my dear friend, Deborah, we were like, they cannot be just left alone. It's that grief and isolation. So that's where that came from. And then Luna, the nursing assistant, very much based on a nursing assistant named JR, who I loved, who took such beautiful care of my mom. And he met with me for breakfast many times while I picked his brain about how would this work? And is this part of your job? And where do you sign in? And just making sure I had it accurate, very close to home.
Books were kind of a savior as far as maintaining a connection. My mother-in-law lived by herself in Texas and we're in Kansas. And I would send her a box of books every month or so. And we would read them. My husband would listen to the audiobook. We would talk on the phone several times a week. We weren't really doing anything. There wasn't like, so what did you do today? Well, you're really nothing. Yeah. But we had those books to discuss. And so that was kind of nice to be able to have that connect over. And I mean, Emma Straub's bookstore, Books Are Magic. I think they are.
They are. They truly are. And you know, I teach creative writing at a university and also to adults elsewhere. But we always talk about that when people start to doubt themselves and they're like, I don't know, does this really matter? Is this important? I'm like, stories really matter. Just look at our most recent history with the pandemic. When people talk about what got them through, it's frequently shows they binged or books they read. And both of those are storytelling. And so stories will always matter to us. Always, always.
Your novel takes a multi-generational approach. How did you manage the points of view?
You know, it's funny. It seems like a tangent, but that's what drew me to the book in the first place is I had this goal to do an intergenerational friendship story. So I started working on these characters in 2019 and I was struggling to figure out a way to bring them together. And I know I hate to say it was a happy accident. It was for the book, but not to trivialize the horrible things that were happening in the world.
Right.
But COVID became, it gave the urgency for them to have to literally live together. So I had been working with Vivian and Cooper, the very angry teenage boy, just trying to play around with how will they meet each other? How will they, you know, come together? I did used to teach middle school. So the managing of the point of views, I have to say, and I hate these kind of answers, but these characters came to me so clearly, way far more than any other book. And it might be, it was the time that I was writing it, maybe I didn't have as many distractions because I was in lockdown myself. They just came to me and were like my friends and my escape, kind of. Ren, the 11-year-old, is very much drawn from a friend of mine named Dara, who she's an adult but has cerebral palsy. We'd been friends a long time. Mm-hmm. When I told her, I think I want this little girl in a wheelchair and I may have to pick your brain, she was so thrilled. And that also gave her a pandemic project. And she's the one who shared with me how occupational therapy was canceled, physical therapy was canceled. And these physical therapists would try to work with her through video, and her family members would try to help her do the exercises and things. And it was just so frustrating. Her life just got so small during COVID. It's funny because I wrote them and I would sometimes write many, many scenes where it was just written, traveling through the story. And then later in revision, I would be like, okay, we don't need this. This will be where Cooper comes in. And this will be, but I would write the same scene from all points of view sometimes, and then decide who had the most at stake, who changed the most in that scene. And that's who would get to be the point of view. And sometimes I would just know this is Rin's scene or this is Vivian's scene. Mm-hmm. It's clearly theirs. They were just fun people to go to the playground with every day during, I was stuck at home.
Interesting what you just said a few minutes ago about storytelling in talking to your friend and saying, I might pick your brain. That opened the door for her to have her story told on some level. And people want to see themselves in the books and the movies that they consume. Has she read it?
Yes. And she loves it. And she's in my acknowledgments. Learned so much from her. So she got to tell her story, and her story changed me. So I'm kind of cringing at the fact that I called Vivian's home handicapped accessible, because like Dara is one of the people who taught me a lot of my old outdated language. The house is just accessible, right? Mm-hmm. And just some of the language that I was using, I was unintentionally offensive. And, my dad has a physical disability. And so I've had this all my life. She just helped me see it differently. Again, power of storytelling and how important that is, that she got to tell hers. And in the telling of it, she changed me and hopefully changes some readers as well.
How did you decide whose story would drive the action?
For a while in the early draft, the neighbors were also points of view. There's a gay couple that lives next to Vivian's old home. And so she calls them the boys, and the boys were points of view for a while. And then I just narrowed it to just the pod. I think it's really Vivian's book. And she kind of hands it off at the end to Cooper, is how I saw it. Her action is what drives everything else that happens. But then, like I said, it would be sometimes I wouldn't know for a particular scene who's driving this. And it always comes down to who's going to change the most during the scene, or who has the biggest need during the scene, the biggest wish, or, facing the biggest obstacle, that kind of thing, the most at stake.
We love those stakes, don't we?
Oh, yes, we do.
Along the way, has your process changed, or has it?
It has, yes. You typically will ask people, are you a pantser or are you a plotter? Mm-hmm. And I kind of morphed. I'm still kind of in between, but I used to be total pantser. The first draft was just kind of the whole discovery and figuring things out, telling myself the story. But then over the years, just to save time, and the more I learned about the craft, what I'll do now is I won't actually start until I'll play around for a long time with journals and character exercises and stuff like that. And when I know these are going to be my points of view, and sometimes in a novel, it's only one. I've had two, and then this book has four, obviously. But if I know what each point of view character wants, what is their motivation? And what are three things that are going to stand in their way? At least three is good to start with, right? Hopefully more will emerge as you tell the story. Then I feel like I can start the actual document on my computer and go forward. Then when I'm done with that first draft, because I know you had Jessica Brody recently, and I love the...
Save the cat. The
cat for a novelist, yeah. Right? One of the things I'll do about midway through a first draft, I like to visit those 15 beats and just kind of see, am I on track? And I don't like plan them in advance, but I'm like, am I on track? These things are looking good, right? And then when I'm finished with the draft, that's when I outline, but I outline as is. And that outline as is, like Tiffany Yates Martin in her wonderful book, Intuitive Editing, she calls it the X-ray, where it's kind of an outline where you just list every single action that happens. And that's what allows me to see like the repetition, the holes, the gaps, what I have too much of this and not enough of that. And then so I can like figure out a revision plan based on that. So it's become like this in between plotting and pacing, but a lot more organization than I used to have, because I didn't know when I started. I didn't know a lot of this stuff. And my goal is always to make new mistakes, right? So like, feel like a beginner. I don't know if you feel that way, but every book.
Novel,
it's like, yep. How do people do this? Like what, you know, like I have no recollection of how I did it before, but I feel like each time you learn, it never gets easier, but I understand things a little better each time, or at least things that I messed up before, I have a better understanding of how not to make that mistake again. And I was a dancer and then I was in theater, and those careers have very strong apprenticeship programs, very strong craft. Like a dancer takes class every day. Mm-hmm. Actors do as well. And it's just, I feel like I just want to keep learning. I just want to keep getting better and better each time, understanding this whole crazy process a little better each time. That's the goal anyway.
People look at writing as a creative exercise, just like dancing, just like music. And if you're not doing it from the outside, it kind of looks like that. Like we just sit down and write. No, it's easy.
Right.
But you're writing, yeah, you get this feeling and you don't know what it is, but you know when there's something just not, it's not that it's bad, it's just not clicking right. And the only way I have found to figure it out, I mean, other than just praying and meditating and hoping and asking my friends to read my book, is to do that, where you do that x-ray and really look at it on like a diagnostic level. I used a book when I very first started called Story Grid. I had come out of working for the national nonprofit where we had to do metrics all the time. And so I kind of applied those metrics and I built an Excel spreadsheet and I kept track of my word counts like every day, not just like how many I was doing, but how many I needed to do. And then I would know that this plot point needs to happen at 22%. This one, and it kind of worked, but it was really hard to keep track of. You know, I think once you kind of know what you're doing, you can do it in reverse and it's easier. So I would not recommend doing it as you go. It's like trying to ask the driver's ed teacher for a grade while you're learning to drive. Right. Not a good idea.
I don't know about you, but I've also learned, like, if I try to do too much of it, this is just my process. When I've tried to do too much of that outlining or the beats early on, like at the very beginning of a first draft, I get way too much in my own way. I get really self-conscious. Mm-hmm. And then all the discovery goes out the window. I found this kind of nice balance that works for me. And that's one of the things I try to impart to my students is like, if you've never done this, here's a method that works for me, try it, but you're going to need to finesse it and make it your own. There's not one right way to do this. There are a million right ways, but you got to find the one that speaks to you and helps you, you know?
Something that no one talks about, something I've discovered just through this process, is that you have to make room for your subconscious.
Yes.
People will ask you, where do you get these ideas? And half the time you go, I have no clue.
I don't know.
If you stick to those hard and fast outlines, you don't make wiggle room. That's where you kind of lose that magic, I think.
Yeah, it becomes like a straitjacket. This is what I have to stick to this, even though this much better idea has occurred to me, but nope. I can't go there.
We were going this way. Yeah. We're taking this route.
Exactly. So people always ask about where you get your ideas. And I'm always like, it's as if they want there to be this magical website, ideas.com. Here's where you get, you know, like, I'm like, you get them. Like you said, you have no idea, because it's just from keeping your eyes open as a human being on this planet. You know, the ideas are everywhere. And it's always a collection of things you learned as a kid, or some story you remember when you were 15 and something that happened to you yesterday. It's all like this mosaic of stuff, and a bunch of it's just made up. What you said about leaving space for your creativity, for me, that a lot of that comes in solitude. Like whether it's just walking the dog by myself, or walking in the woods by myself, or just noodling around in a journal. Mm-hmm. I make a lot of discoveries in the act of writing, but some of it's just, it's playing around in your head. I have to have a lot of time alone for that. Mm-hmm. So thank goodness I have an amazing partner who gets it. He's not offended when I'm like, I need the afternoon to myself. He understands.
When you are not writing, you've been known to teach these happy class seminars. Yeah. What could one expect to learn from one of your happy classes?
Oh my gosh, where do I begin with that one? It's not a lecture in like, here are 57 habits of furiously happy people that will make you are more, you know, stressed out in your already overbooked life. It's that really focuses on three simple practices that we already kind of know, and it just sort of reinforces it. One of them is practicing gratitude, because gratitude and happiness are cousins. They're so closely related. I mean, they may as well be siblings. They're kind of siblings more than cousins, and then practicing some self-care and practicing play. My young adult novel is called Reasons to be Happy. And when that book came out, my publicist from Sourcebooks said, you should do a Reasons to be Happy blog. And so for that year that the book came out, every single day I posted a reason to be happy. And I never ran out of reasons. And sometimes there was a story, sometimes there was a picture, a recipe, whatever. But what happened without me asking for it is people started sending me their reasons. Like they'd send me an email, you know, I liked the book. Here's what I thought. Here are my top 10 reasons to be happy. And they wanted to share them. And I quickly saw that they fell into categories. Like some were just people's favorites, you know, Reese's peanut butter pumpkins or the way crunches under your feet when it's frosty. But then they would list things like my dad coming home from Afghanistan or having a safe place to live, you know, or having a warm bed to sleep in. And you're like, so those are very different, right? You can be grateful for both of those things, but being grateful for Reese's cups and having a safe home are very different. And that's what got me thinking about these categories of happiness. And so in the classes, it's very interactive and we do these reasons to be happy lists. And it's just really fun and uplifting in a time when there's so much bad news swirling all around us. And a lot of people, especially now, feel like, well, maybe I'm not supposed to be happy. Here are all these people suffering. And I'm, you know, people are trying to do advocacy and activism. You have to take care of yourself. And pursuing your own happiness is part of self-care, or you're going to end up experiencing what I call outrage fatigue, where you just get numb to it all and you don't care anymore. None of us want that. You know, being an aware and awake person trying to make the world better and being happy are not mutually exclusive. And so that's what the class really focuses on, is that we're worth this and we can actually do better for the world if we take a little time for some play occasionally.
Oh yeah. Pickleball is my go-to. Oh, and jigsaw puzzles. I've been doing a lot of jigsaw puzzles. The book ideas have been coming to me through that. It's been great.
Yes. So it makes us more productive. I started doing puzzles. I mean, my mom used to love them before she got ill. And so we had a bunch of her old ones and I started doing them during the pandemic. And I was like, and I got hooked and now I just love them.
My husband goes, oh, Amazon's here again. I'm like, oh, I don't know what it is, but it sounds like a puzzle. You are an animal person. I saw pictures of your little mini beagle on your site. How do animals inspire your writing?
Oh my gosh. I have always been an animal person. And they've always been huge parts of my life. They're members of the family. Mm-hmm. And so every one of my books has at least one non-human character that's just as important as the human cast. So in Morning in This Broken World, it's a big fat cat named Ox. I just feel like they give us so much. And there are days that I feel like we don't deserve them. They are so good in what they give us. But even if it's just something like their resilience. In my past, I had a three-legged cat who ends up in my book, The Blessings of the Animals. And he never spent, as far as I could tell, a single moment thinking like, oh, poor me, or why did this happen to me? He just adapted and moved on as a three-legged cat. He was caught in a trap in someone's yard. Oh. He was a barn cat. He wasn't mine, but he was in my life. And he was just remarkable. They can teach us so much if we pay attention to that. My idea is always to populate my stories like I populate my world. And so there's the kinds of people in my life and there's always animals in my life. So they're always going to be in the books as well. Rita Mae Brown talked about that with LGBTQ characters. She said, I want to populate my books like the people I see in my world. I'm not getting her quote verbatim, but that's where that comes from.
What has writing taught you about yourself?
Between my previous book, which was that young adult book, came out in 2011, and Morning in This Broken World just came out this year. I had a very long publishing drought. I kept writing through all of it, but I was just suddenly in this place where I couldn't find homes for my books. And I kept writing, but I really started to wonder, like, is my place in the publishing world over? Like, I have 5 books in the world, but it was suddenly such a struggle to try to get the 6th out. And things had happened. Editors leave, agents retire, things like that. And, you know, so it was like starting all over again. And at one point I thought, maybe I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to try not to write. And I literally tried to quit writing. And my partner could tell you, I'm not a very pleasant person when I'm not writing. And so one of the things I learned is that I need this to be a happy and productive person in my life. And so writing really taught me that it is part of how I make sense of the world. It is part of how I look at things and process the things that happen to me, that happen to my friends, that are happening globally. And they may not always work their way into books, but it's that part of my process of understanding myself and the world that I'm in and how these things happen and all that kind of stuff is part of who I am. And so I tried to completely separate my publishing life from my writing life. And I made peace with the fact that I will always be a writer. I may never publish again, but I'm always going to be a writer. And of course, I kept trying to publish again. Mm-hmm. And eventually it happened, which is awesome. Yay. But I think that's what it really taught me is that I need it. And that it's really part of how I just move through the world. It really did test me. And I always tell that to students, you need to know why you're doing this. And I had to figure that out because it couldn't just be about being published. And, you know, otherwise, you know, after all those years are ticking by, you know, to be getting something from it. Otherwise, why don't you quit? It helped me really clarify, like, why are you doing this? And that I would keep doing it, even if I didn't get readers. But fortunately, that all turned around.
I think an Amazon First Picks book, I would say
so. It's kind of a fun comeback.
So what's next for you?
See, this is my luck. This is so weird. I do have a book, the second book that we hoped would also be with Lake Union, but my editor there, who I loved, has left editing. He has left publishing altogether.
Oh, no.
So I'm being handed to someone else. And you just never know, right? Is there going to be the click? Is there going to be the spark? So it might be a start over again, but I have the most amazing agent who really believes in this next book. And so if we have to, we will go elsewhere, but it's kind of, and you know, nothing's going to happen. We're recording this right before the holidays. So it's probably not going to do anything at this point until the new year. So I can put it out of my head for a while. But I've also started playing with something brand new because that's the nature of the beast. You can't just wait around. You just, what'll be next? What'll be next?
The question is, do I have the days ahead of me to do them all?
I know. I guess that's a good problem to have, that long queue in your head of like all these story ideas. I probably can't possibly finish them all, but you know, it's fun to try.
Do you have any advice for new writers?
I think based especially on the story I just told you, I always tell people you have to develop the tenacity of a mule. As many of your other guests have said very similar things about just learn to persist. And especially like as many of my newest students just started submitting. And one girl, she was so excited because she got her first rejection letter. And I'm like, that is exactly the attitude to have. I've known too many people who like, they'll get like four or five rejections and they're like, well, I guess I suck. I'll just quit. And you're like, no, this is only the beginning. And you've just got to persist. You have to know you want it. You have to know why you want it and just be stubborn as a mule. And I've had a mule in my life, so I know this is true. Their reputation is earned.
Thank you, Katrina.
Thank you, Chris. This was a true pleasure.
To learn more, visit KatrinaKittle.com. If you're enjoying The Writing Table, please consider leaving us a review. There are so many podcasts out there. Reviews help other listeners find us. Thanks so much for your support.